From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Do classical musicians have a role to play in advancing social justice? Peabody composer Judah Adashi thinks so. He talks with us about art, activism, and the delicate balance between social critique and propaganda.
Just as in any artistic venture, there's a lot of not very good art that's been made around sociopolitical issues.
Then we hear about a new Johns Hopkins Film Fund with a special focus on Baltimore. Those who make the cut get mentoring from experts in the industry, as well as cash in some cases. The fellows include artists with in-depth experience and some who've never made a film. Have a great idea? You're eligible. It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. It's On the Record. That's the opening of a piece called Rise, a collaboration by composer Judah Adashi and poet Tamika Cage Conley. Adashi's website describes the subject of Rise as, quote, America's fraught civil rights journey from Selma to Ferguson and beyond, end quote. The 40-minute piece for double choir and chamber ensemble premiered last year in Washington, as it turned out, on the same day Freddie Gray died in Baltimore. We're talking this morning about social justice and the role of the artist, composer Judah Adashi, who is on the faculty of the Peabody Institute, frequently takes on social issues in his work. Adashi is teaching a new workshop at the Peabody on art and activism, and he's here with me in the studio. Judah Adashi, welcome to On the Record.
Thank you so much for having me, Sheila.
So what led you to take on the subject of America's civil rights journey?
Well, so this is something that I've had an abiding interest in since, I would say, high school, when I finally got to the point in my life as an artist where my artistic interests and abilities were able to intersect with things that I was passionate about. And I had a commission for a piece that was large scale, 40 minutes. I felt that this was something I could really delve into in a meaningful way.
And you worked with a poet.
Correct. Dr. Tamika Cage Conley. She's an African-American poet. And I had initially set out to do that piece, Rise, using existing poetry. There's so much beautiful work documenting the civil rights movement from the 50s and the 60s. But I think, as we're vividly and painfully aware at this moment, this is an ongoing movement. This is not a movement that ended. We're very much in this today, and I wanted a young poet and a young African-American voice to kind of speak to this with me so that we could explore this journey that took us, as I said, from Selma to the present day together.
What do you think music can do in terms of social justice that a documentary or a book doesn't do?
So I really think of making art in general as an act of empathy. No matter what you're doing, it doesn't have to be concerned with social justice. I think when you're writing a piece of music, you know, most of the time you're inspired by something. In my case, it's often literature. I often read a poem or a book, or I may encounter a situation or a person that moves me in some way, someone I admire, someone I want to pay homage to, something I want to bear witness to in some way. And I think music allows you to do that, first of all, in an abstract way, whether they're words or it's purely instrumental. I think music lets you do that at many levels. You don't have to be explicit about it. I think you can do it in a way that carries different degrees of subtlety that may not be possible in journalism and documentary. And then the other aspect of this that's important to me is music takes place in time. And obviously a documentary does as well, but I think you have a lot of say as a composer in how you create an experience around something. So if you're telling a story around the civil rights movement, if you're telling a story, I'm doing in my next piece, about Kalief Browder, this young man who'd killed himself not long after being in solitary confinement at Rikers Island, you have the opportunity to create a space where the audience has to sit with it for a certain amount of time. They have to sit with the narrative. They have to sit with the discomfort of the story. They have to kind of abide with this person and with this idea and with this pain. I think that's something that music brings that is singular.
Let me pick up on the piece that you're working on about Kalief Browder. You told us a little bit. Mm-hmm. Tell us more about what grabbed you about his story.
Absolutely. So Kalief Browder's story is not singular, unfortunately. It is a powerful example, I think. Kalief Browder, just to share his story for people who don't know it, was a young man who at age 16 in 2010 was arrested in the Bronx, accused of stealing a backpack. He was taken to Rikers Island, where he was held for 3 years, two of them spent in solitary confinement. And at no point was he convicted of a crime, but he spent this time there nonetheless. His trial was repeatedly delayed and delayed and delayed, and ultimately the charges were dropped. You know, over 1,000 days on Rikers Island, he was released, and then roughly a year and some change after he was released, he committed suicide, presumably because of the effects of that experience on his life. You know, I read an article, a stunning article by Jennifer Gonerman in The New Yorker that really told Kalief Browder's story. She interviewed him just as he was released, and sadly, he committed suicide in 2015. When I read this story, I think what interests me most, I would say, are the immediate human dimensions of these sociopolitical issues, when you can really look at a person, especially a young person, that embodies something systemic. This stayed with me, and when I had an opportunity to apply for a grant, that was the story that I wanted to tell.
So tell me what your creative process is, then, to try to make art of that.
It's difficult. I'm far removed from Kalief Browder in so many ways, in age, in race, in life experience, in privilege, in any number of ways. You know, I've done a lot of reading about the case. That's been one thing that I've been able to do. But I've looked for small but meaningful and human points of entry into his story. So one thing I did was I went up to New York City and spent the day kind of walking in his footsteps. Not all the way to Rikers Island. That's a difficult part to achieve. But the first part of his story, where sort of the beginning of this long descent that led to his suicide, I went to Arthur Avenue in the Bronx, and spent quite some time at the intersection where he was arrested, just trying to imagine just walking through this beautiful neighborhood. But that day was the beginning of the end for Kalief Browder. So I spent time there, and I sort of tracked his path following Jennifer Gonerman's article, went to the precinct where he was brought, then he went to the courthouse, and, you know, he was on this inexorable path that he did not know at that point would lead to Rikers Island, and specifically to all this time, not only on Rikers, but in solitary. I can't presume to enter into his mind, but I tried to walk in his footsteps a little bit, literally. Jennifer's article also talks about little things about him, the books he read in prison. I'm reading those. You know, I'm just trying to do what I can to draw a little closer to this person, and I feel that if I can arrive at that point of empathy, that gives me an avenue to open it up to others so that we can all sit with this and think about how we are maybe complicit in it.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with composer Judah Adashi about social justice and the role of the artist. What pitfalls do you see in making music that is overtly political?
Oh, there's so many. You know, it's a risk, and I think you have to make decisions about what are you prioritizing? Are you an artist first? Are you an activist? What are you doing? And
Do you have an answer to that?
An artist first, absolutely. I think that just as in any artistic venture, there's a lot of not very good art that's been made around sociopolitical issues. And sometimes when you try too hard to make a point, I think that can become very heavy-handed. I think that can become very preachy. I said earlier that I think one of the things that music can do is exercise varying degrees of subtlety and restraint. I hope, you know, what these works are maybe able to do is create a space for communion where people can sit together and let this story in and see what it does to them. One of the things we're reading in this art and activism workshop I'm teaching is an article by a composer friend of mine named David T. Little. He makes a distinction between two kinds of art about politics or engaging in sociopolitical issues. He says there's revolutionary art, which is ideological and tries to change minds. And then he says there's critical art, which is more open-ended. It looks at things much as a documentary would. It looks at things from multiple perspectives. It may have an ideological slant. Obviously, I have strong opinions about Kalief Browder's story. But the point is less to say you should think this and more let me tell this story so that we don't erase it in our historical memory. Let me, as he puts it, an act of counter-memory, you know, making sure that we fight amnesia, that we don't let the Kalief Browders of the world just become hashtags, just become, you know, a rallying cry, that this is a human being. This is a young boy who didn't get to see his life into his 20s because he was accused of stealing a backpack and nothing more. And that, I think, that isn't politics. I think that's deeply human and something I hope I can make something of through music.
Before I let you go, tell me about this art and activism workshop.
All of this project has been made possible by a grant from the Berman Institute of Bioethics. They spearheaded this initiative called the Practical Ethics Initiative, which sort of casts a wider net of questions to people in, you know, in nursing, in business, in public health, in music. How do we deal with ethical issues in our field? And so to me, that was a twofold question. I know a little bit of the answer for myself, which is I do like to engage with these issues in my music. So part of the grant application was this piece about Kalief Browder. The other part was this workshop that I wanted to run with my students at Peabody. And I have a cohort of about 10 students who were selected, and we're spending the fall semester in a kind of seminar asking some of the questions you're asking me, in a way. What can music do, especially classical music, that is often on the fringes of these conversations? What can we do to engage with these issues that we're passionate about in the world meaningfully? Each of these students has their own project that they'd like to get off the ground. And so in the fall, we're focusing on more of a seminar where we can all discuss these issues broadly. And then we're going to zoom in to kind of a practicum in the spring and see what we can do to help them launch their own efforts to intertwine their musical gifts and their musical training and musical work with social justice-oriented projects.
You use the word responsibility in describing this workshop, this art and activism workshop, which raises for me the question, is a musician who does not address social causes abdicating responsibility?
I think the answer is no. I think the answer is different for everybody. I mean, there are many artists I admire who keep these things very separate. People will cite one of my heroes, Nina Simone, saying that she believes it's an artist's duty to reflect the times. How can you be an artist and not reflect the times? I think for me that rings true, but I don't wish to impose that on my students. I want them to go on this journey of figuring out how they can engage meaningfully. What, you know, what is the point where their art and their concerns about how life in their city and life in their world is working, where do those things touch? And how do those things touch in a way that they can make a meaningful difference? Again, I don't think there's one path for everybody on this, but I hope that through this exploration, they can find their path.
Thank you for discussing it with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Judah Adashi is a composer on the faculty of the Peabody Institute at the Johns Hopkins University. He's also founder and artistic director of the Evolution Contemporary Music Series. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, there's a link to listen to the full invocation from his composition, Rise. This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Quick break now. When we come back, we'll hear about another Hopkins arts endeavor, a fund to support budding audiovisual artists. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR, become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're turning now from music to film. A new project at Johns Hopkins aims to provide mentors, and in some cases cash, for Baltimoreans with creative audiovisual ideas. With me in the studio to explain is Roberto Busso Garcia. He heads Johns Hopkins University's Saul Zentz Innovation Fund in Film and Media. Roberto Busso Garcia, welcome to On the Record.
Thanks for having me here, Sheila. Pleasure.
Before we get into the nuts and bolts of the fund, who was Saul Zentz?
He was a music producer and a film producer. He was a maverick. He wanted to turn literary works that he thought were important works of art into films that nobody wanted to finance. So he went out and he self-financed movies like Amadeus and The English Patient and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Mr. Sands.
It's hard to think no one wanted to finance those films.
That's right, isn't it? Today, but even after the critical and commercial success of them, it would be almost impossible for him to find studio backing. So he went out. He really believed in finding ways of getting the message across.
What is the goal of this fund that's named after him?
To identify and empower bold new voices in the world of audiovisual content development and production here in Baltimore. We want to find those people with great potential and great ideas and bridge the gap between them and the access to resources.
And it's not just for screenwriters.
That's correct. It's for almost anything, as long as it has an audiovisual component. We have documentaries, we have virtual reality experiences, we have multimedia installations, we have short films, we have experimental animations. Of course, we have features and screenplays as well.
And is it primarily for young people just starting out?
Not at all. Doesn't matter your age, doesn't matter who you are, where you've come from, what you've done. It's about the power of the idea and the vision of the artist. And once we identify that, we try to create a team around it. And it's pretty challenging, but it's fascinating. We found some incredibly interesting ideas of people that never had the chance to have their voices heard. And that's our mission.
Well, before I ask you to talk about some of the individuals, I'm curious about something. The fund stipulates that the projects must be produced in Baltimore.
That's correct.
Why is that?
Well, we wanted this fund to be about Baltimore, not necessarily the stories, but about the people who live in the city as well as Hopkins. We wanted to be a unifying force between the Hopkins community and the Baltimore community at large. And we felt that by requiring the projects to be produced here, we help create that continuity of production from locally developed content, not necessarily the big movies and television shows that come from outside, but sadly at some point have to leave, but that we can continue to develop projects from here that stay here, or that projects that are developed elsewhere can come here and be shot here.
Is there a Baltimore voice? Is it about people building a career here, or is it that people here might have something unique to say, or both?
I think it's both, for sure. The Baltimore voice is as diverse and unique and dynamic as the city itself. We've started to see by the projects being selected, our artists come from all walks of life, all kinds of levels of experience, of incredibly different interests. So that is the voice. You know, when you put them all together, not each project by itself, but all of it together, it's the Baltimore visual arts community.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Roberto Busso Garcia, director of the Johns Hopkins University Saul Zantz Innovation Fund in Film and Media. So the first round of fellows completed their tenure with the fund this summer.
That's right.
Give us a sense of their experience.
I think it was overwhelmingly positive from the feedback we've received. We had a screenplay lab in April, and there were five projects selected. One of them went into production. That's Matt Porterfield's Solar's Point.
Solar's Point.
Solar's Point, yeah.
What is it about?
Solar's Point chronicles the difficulties of a young man re-entering society after a spell in prison. And it's about that community in Solar's Point. You know, Matt is known for its observational and powerful cinema about specific people living in specific Baltimore places. And Solar's Point is part of that track. So that went into production. We have another one called Noor that's about to go into production, and it was completely changed by the experience in the lab. So Daniel Nassana, who's a Johns Hopkins student, entered with a project that was meant to be a feature-length screenplay, and it was more about the architecture in certain aspects of Baltimore, created a sense of competition into this young Middle Eastern woman here in Baltimore, and that transformed into an exploration of the challenges of being a Middle Eastern woman in Baltimore. And now it's called Noor. It's more of a medium-length film. It's a lot more focused and a lot more explosive. And Daniel has plans of going into production in the winter.
Those are projects that were worked on. Were there classes? Were there?
No, for the lab, we were looking for.
That was a lab.
That was the lab. We were looking for screenplays that were at least at the first draft level. Because then what happens in the lab is a four-day intensive boot camp where we bring five screenwriters. We had one, you know, we had Martin Salinas from Buenos Aires. We had Daniel Martin from I Like It Like That. We had Zach, who co-wrote Oliver Stone's JFK. Jeremy Pixer, who co-wrote Bullworth. I mean, all these brilliant, very successful screenwriters, but with very different visions and very different sensibilities. They study the screenplays, and then they meet with the fellows, as we call them, for 2 hours each on one-to-one, just like really going through their scripts and asking questions and pushing the envelope on who these filmmakers are as artists, as writers, as people. And through that process of questioning, then the screenwriter comes out with, you know, a ton of new perspectives, and then she or he can make changes that they deem are best for the vision of the project.
And then separate from that, there's something you call an incubator.
Yes.
What is that?
Well, the incubator is the heart of the program, the Saul Zantz Innovation Program. We call it Bold Voices New Paradigms Incubator. It's a mentorship program. The project selected there will be matched with at least two mentors in the industry from, you know, all kinds of places in the world. These mentors are people in different fields that will help push the project and the artists to the next level. Our advisors come from LA, from Paris, from London, from Mexico City, from New York, from Baltimore, obviously. They are there to provoke the artist, to ask difficult questions that have not been answered by the project in its nascent stages, hoping not only to find the best version of the project within the artists, but also to create a team of experts that will help make the project a reality. We do have a financial component in the fund, but it's not enough to produce some of the more ambitious projects. So we're trying then to help these projects get made at the highest level, even if it's outside of the fund.
So how many applicants have you had altogether, and how many have been accepted?
So I would say anywhere between 175 and 200 applicants in these first two rounds, and it's only been, 9 months?
and how many of them have actually been picked for either the laboratory or the incubator?
So the first round, we had 5 projects in the screenwriter's lab and 13 projects in the incubator. In this round, we have 5 projects for the documentary lab starting this week, and we have 9 projects in the incubator. So it's a total of, I think, 32 projects in this first year.
How do you make those choices?
We have a selection committee. Every round is composed of different people, anywhere between 15 and 20 filmmakers, executives, curators, writers, producers, again, from all over the world. It happens online. They don't know who the applicants are. They don't know their work they've done. They just read the proposal, and each proposal is analyzed by at least three of these evaluators. And then we take all the recommendations in stride, and the advisory committee from all that makes the final decisions. We believe it's a very fair, blind process. I've been a filmmaker and an executive. I've been on both sides for all my life of the industry. So I've gone through these processes many times on both sides, and I've seen how bias can seep in even with people not wanting to. So we were trying to really keep bias out, since our mission is to truly identify those voices out there that, because of the power of the idea or the concept, should be, you know, taken to the next level, no matter whether the people were artists or not artists, whether they had made a movie before or never made a movie, no matter their age, their creed, their color, their gender.
So if somebody listening to this wants to try to get in on this, what should they do?
Well, they should go to our website.
We will link to your website from the On the Record page at WIPR.
And send us a note. The next round is going to be early next year. But we do have monthly educational workshops free for the and open to the public. They just have to register and show up. They happen at the Johns Hopkins University MICA Film Center.
So even if somebody doesn't get accepted into the program, they're still learning that they can do connected to the Zenz Fund.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Zenz Fund is for Baltimore, and it goes beyond just the incubator and the labs.
I really appreciate your telling us about it.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a
Congratulations.
Pleasure.
It sounds like a lot of fun to work on.
It's a lot of fun. A lot of work. A lot of fun.
Roberto Busso Garcia is director of Johns Hopkins University Saul Zenz Innovation Fund in Film and Media. More information on the Record page at WIPR.org. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Kast. Hope you'll tune in tomorrow. And for all observing Yom Kippur, have an easy fast. Gmar Tov.